Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here, or trying to be here. Sitting across from me is co-host
Mike Cosentino, right here. Good morning,
beloved
morning.
Co-host Mike Cosentino.
Yes, beloved.
And our silent Gary LeMaster.
Semi-silent.
That's
Gary
right.
LeMaster.
Moved into speech.
We have Eva Sargent, who is the Southwest Director of Defenders of Wildlife, calling in today from Tucson, I think. And we want to talk about the Mexican gray wolves, wolves in general, as a endangered species. Are you there, our caller?
I am there.
Okay.
Eva Sargent is right there.
How did you get in? What's your background, and how did you get in, involved with the with working full time for a conservation organization? And
you know, my background is I was a kid who was always interested in nature and always, like, you know, down at the end of the street. I grew up in Texas, down at the end of the street, you know, in the ditch or the little creek, you know, sifting for tadpoles. And when I went to school, when I was in college, I couldn't decide what to do. I started out as a wildlife major, and then I switched to zoology. And then I always had a fascination with zoos, and I started out in the zoo biz as a researcher and a conservationist, worked at a couple of zoos. And after doing that for a long time, and I love the zoo business, I love the educational aspect of it and how people can see critters that they might never see in the wild. But after a while, I wanted to do more on the conservation side, and I had worked some on conservation issues in Madagascar. And I decided that, you know, Madagascar was about as far away as I could get without being on my way back home again.
There
and I
go.
Just decided I wanted to work where I live and be able to, you know, travel just an hour and see something that I was doing some good for. And I just love working for Defenders. It's just a great organization, you know, based on science, and it fits me perfectly.
We were talking about the show. I think one of your Facebook pages has 300,000 likes or 300,000 people following it or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Defenders' Facebook page, and, you know, I'd encourage people to look at that. We really work on keeping that up to date and interesting for people.
We do want to complete that circle and say that we have a lot of people interested in environmental issues who listen to Democratic Perspective. And so please go to the Facebook page and check it out if you're interested. So what's going on with the – go ahead.
Yeah, we want to focus on Mexican gray wolf,
right,
which is, I understand, a subspecies of the gray wolf and the most endangered one in the United States and, I guess, Mexico, too. So
it's
tell
actually,
us
– go ahead. Sorry.
No, just tell us a little bit about, for my reading, the Mexican gray wolf is probably one of the first wolves to make it across the Bering Straits into to North America, the first subspecies to do so, or something like that.
Wow, you did do your homework. You're reading. That's great. Yes, Mexican wolves are the lineage that first made it into North America, and they probably headed south, and they're still hanging on, you know, but just barely, just by a thread. They are the most endangered subspecies of gray wolf in the world, and, you know, there's only 109, more or less, in the wild in the United States, in Arizona, and New Mexico, and there's only fewer than a dozen in the wild in Mexico.
Wow.
So they are a species that, you know, there's some in captivity, obviously. They were saved by a captive breeding program. That's one of the reasons I have great respect for the zoo business. You know, they were just about extinct. They were extinct in the wild. They were not around in the wild. They were only in captivity, and they were brought back. So
I think the last wild gray wolf I was reading was killed in 1970 in Arizona, the last one we had in Arizona. So what happened in 1976? The gray wolves are so endangered. They're only in zoos or in other facilities. why was the decision made to release them into the wild, and how successful has it been?
Well, the idea to release them in the wild is because, you know, you can't really say that anything is recovered or saved when you can only go to, you know, a zoo and see it. The purpose, you know, of the Endangered Species Act is not only to conserve the species themselves, but also to conserve the habitat where they live. And, of course, all the wolves play a really important role in the environment. So it's really important to have our wolves, our Mexican gray wolves, back in Arizona and New Mexico. And they did come back from 7 founders. Every Mexican wolf alive in the world today is related to the 7 founders of the captive population. And, you know, they were first released in 1998, and the population was growing pretty well, and then we had a period where the management was shifted from the federal government to the state government, and a whole lot of wolves were removed, and not very many were released, and that caused the population to bottom out and actually decline. And
we
when
should
that
talk
control
about the,
was returned to the, sorry, go ahead.
We should talk about the Arizona Game and Fish Commission and their interaction with the federal government on preserving species, and also with other organizations. There have been protests up in Flagstaff about their activities with the gray wolf, trying to limit its range and so forth and so on. What's that dispute about, Eva?
That dispute is basically about states' rights and about the Arizona Game and Fish Commission and the department's idea that the federal government shouldn't be managing species in Arizona. And, you know, the federal government only comes in to manage species when they're endangered. And they get endangered when, basically, over the years, state management has failed them. So I can understand anybody doesn't want somebody else coming in and taking their power and taking their job. But that's basically the dynamic is a states' rights dynamic.
But didn't Arizona Game and Fish want to delist the Mexican gray wolf when there were only about 40 of them in the wild? They wanted to delist them as an endangered species. So
yes.
That doesn't seem very conservation-oriented.
It doesn't seem very conservation-oriented to defenders of wildlife either. And it's a real worry because, you know, the Game and Fish Commission and the department need to represent the interest of all Arizonans, and support for Mexican wolves in Arizona is enormous. I mean, any politician would be very happy to have 77% support.
Wow.
You know, in a random poll.
You bet.
You know, the support is widespread, but the department and the commission do not represent the majority of Arizonans.
So is it that you have the supporters? That 70% figure is huge, and certainly, you know, a lot of people I talk to just love the idea of this predator level of being back in the wild, and somehow we have a better world for it, which I guess is behind a lot of the conservation efforts and the restoration of endangered species. But here we have this rancher environmentalist interface, as we often do in this country, nationwide, maybe the world. So what's the, is it really that the wolves kill too many cattle?
No, it's not that. It's more of an ideological fight in reality. The wolves take an extremely small number of livestock. In Arizona, it's less than 1%. And that's might be over counted because that's based on rancher reports.
Right.
So if anything, that's overcounted. So in other words, it's very small. Now, if they're your cows, that's a legitimate problem.
Yeah.
You know that, even though it's very
doesn't
like threaten the industry. And so there's all kinds of programs. Defenders has programs. We work very hard with ranchers to help them basically ranch in the presence of wolves. The federal government has various kinds of incentives and subsidies and compensation for loss.
So if
what
they
we're
lose
really
their...
in now is an ideological fight about property rights.
So if they lose cattle to wolves, they're compensated for the cattle, but that doesn't solve the problem because it's ideological and it's
exactly.
I was over in the White Mountain, and there was a huge billboard that said more or less "Kill all wolves" or "We hate wolves."
Wow!
I saw the only wolf I've ever seen in the wild over there hiking. And
wow, not to it. You're very lucky. That's fantastic.
It's the one in my life. I was so thrilled to see a wolf after seeing 10,000 coyotes.
Yeah.
Not insulting coyotes or anything, but you know, nice to see a wolf after all these coyote critters.
I don't think the coyotes are going to pick at you.
Yeah, you don't think they're going to go after it.
Pro coyote lobby will be any minute now.
Yeah. Yes.
So it's an ideological struggle, and it strikes me that, I mean, Arizona Game and Fish seems like the ultimate old boys club. At one time, they had one woman on the thing. The head of it was forced out for sexual harassment of female employees. They spend $1 million a year on travel, and they spent $67,000 one year sending the director basically to Washington to lobby for the, I guess there's a it's a states versus federal, and the different game and fish or fish and game departments get together, and they're trying to get a bigger piece of the pie, right? Our problem with them is that they are very much less conservation oriented. I didn't see anyone with a conservation background on their board of directors whatsoever. I mean, they have some good biologists and stuff down the line, but they're all hunters they're all hunters, but they're also all, you know, mostly it's law enforcement background. They don't seem, how much effort is Arizona Game and Fish putting into protecting endangered species, do you think?
You know, I think they do a good job on some species. You know, that's the thing. It's some species they're fine with, you know, ferrets, black-footed ferrets, great program, great interest. Other species, and particularly predators, you know, there's this anti-wolf bias in everything they do. And at the same time, like you said, down the line, helping the ranchers, Arizona Game and Fish has an excellent program helping ranchers, working with the wolves day to day, super dedicated people doing that work, but they're held down at the commission level by these people who basically do not want to see Mexican wolves recovered. They basically sabotage the real recovery that's required under the Endangered Species Act. So, you know, great biologists down the line, but at the top, at the commission, no interest in recovering predators, only lip service. Lip service and sabotage.
Eva, for our listeners, maybe you could explain the benefit or the need for wolves in the environment and what role they play in the ecosystem.
I love that topic.
Go ahead, please. Do it.
as top predators, you know, top predators, top carnivores at the top of the food chain like that, they tend to regulate everything in almost every system they've been examined in. And the simple example is if you're an elk, and there's a whole lot of elk, let's say. Let's go to Yellowstone. That's where we have most of the research. And too many elk, and they're standing around by the streams, and they're eating all the little aspen and willows off when they're only a few inches tall. Well, because there's too many elk, that stops the trees from ever growing tall, and you lose the trees along the riverbed. And when you lose those trees, the water gets dirtier because there's more erosion off the banks, and the water gets shaded. Okay, so now you've changed the environment in the water. And you don't have the trees, so you don't have the birds. You don't have the fish because the water's different. So wolves exert, it's called a trophic cascade, you know, that the effects of wolves cascade through the ecosystem. So when you lose the top predator and you have these elk that just stand around doing nothing but eating all day long, munching willows, and you know, they're not both kept in check by their numbers, but they also don't move because they're not afraid of anything. And that changes everything. So, you know, and once we have enough wolves down here in the Southwest, I think we'll start to see these trophic cascade type effects where they bring back other animals. You know, beaver come back, songbirds come back, fish come back. And that's what we all really want. You know, we want healthy landscapes.
So we have the good side of wolves that at the top of the chain, they create, like you said, this chain reaction all the way down the system. But and maybe the media is not helping us here, that we have these predators that even when they take down an elk or heaven forbid a cattle, you know, that that people, at least people with no understanding or little understanding or little care about environmental issues, don't get why Eva Sargent and wackos like her sitting in the studio this morning want to. Why do you want to bring this dangerous animal back? I mean, you just gave a great explanation, and I appreciate that. But there still is that, and for me, it's more than enough.
Little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Little Red Riding Hood is part of the problem. You know, we have these very primitive, you know, ideas and fears of predators, which are really not based in fact, but we have an outsized idea of the risk because of these sort of fables,
right?
And our heritage running from saber-tooth tigers. That was easy, saber-tooth.
Yeah,
you know,
that would be a dangerous tiger.
We haven't come very far in the very primitive part of our brain is afraid of predators. We don't need to be.
How many wolf attacks have there been in the United States on humans in the last, say, decade?
One.
One.
In Alaska.
Yeah, well, this is like voter fraud, you know?
That was after none for a very, very, very long time.
And that one was probably the result of the human doing something stupid.
That one is maybe not. That one is hard to understand. There wasn't probably a lot of feeding and, you know, feeding by humans and stuff. So that one's hard to understand. There's a recent case this decade in Saskatchewan, in Canada anyway, that was a case where wolves were habituated to humans, you know, feeding off garbage, feeding off things gave them. Yeah. So a lot of times when you do see wolf attacks, they've been fed and lost their fear of humans.
Yeah, like bears.
But a lot of times is, again, like once a decade or less. It's, you know, you're more likely to be killed by a cow or a tractor or a bee sting, you know, all kinds of things. But like I said, we have this primitive fear in the very primitive part of our brain that sort of makes that fear of predators bigger than it logically should be.
Okay, Eva, we're talking to Eva Sargent here of Defenders of Wildlife, and she's going to tell us next, where are the wolves in Arizona and the Southwest, if you don't mind? Where are they? Where are they rehabbing?
They're in Arizona. They're in the Apache National Forest, so over on the border with New Mexico. And in New Mexico, they're in the Gila, the part of the Gila that abuts the Apache. According to the new rules, you know, the federal government, the Fish and Wildlife Service, just made new rules for Mexican wolves, and they'll be able to get out of the small area they've always been confined to, you know, that if they establish territories out there or move back. The area where they'll be allowed to roam is much bigger now. Now, that doesn't mean they're instantly going to be everywhere because there's not very many of them.
Right.
But hopefully we'll start to see them in other good habitats in Arizona. One of the most important places that wolves could go is actually the Grand Canyon ecoregion.
They like that elevation. They like that climate. It's good for them?
It's good. It's fantastic habitat for them. There's very few livestock. There's very few people. It's just great wolf territory.
And are they going to be allowed to go above, what is it, I-40? Isn't that a fight with the Arizona Game and Fish?
That is a huge fight. It's the best science on wolf recovery, the Mexican wolf recovery, the science that was done by the recovery team of the Fish and Wildlife Service and which was published and peer-reviewed says that Mexican wolves, in order to recover, will have to have at least three populations. And the places that have the right habitat and the right amount of prey and the right low human density are the Grand Canyon ecoregion, northern New Mexico, southern Colorado, and where they are now in the Blue Range wolf recovery area. And when you draw a line at I-40 and you say wolves can't go above this line, you've essentially made recovery impossible. And I've got a real problem with that. When your legal mandate is to recover wolves, and science tells you this is what you need to do. You don't put a rule in place that makes that impossible.
I see. And that's all about...
But I'm not bitter about that.
No. But there is a big fight over whether wolves will be allowed above I-40. And if they're not, then they can't go into the Grand Canyon area habitat, which has a lot of elk and deer.
So we're not going to see any wolves on Mingus Mountain anytime soon. There are a number of wilderness areas, but the ones that you mentioned are that far north are the best for the reasons that you also mentioned, the lack of people, the lack of livestock. Just to avoid those conflicts, there's plenty of space left in Arizona where we can re-inhabit wolves and not have the conflicts that we seem to have.
I think you're going to get us in trouble, Mike, if you re-inhabit wolves. It sounds like you're doing
some sort of weird shamanic Sedona spirit thing. I have my spirit hood in my other pocket, and I'll be running around the studio with my wolf thing on in a minute. And then I'll be elected mayor of Sedona. But we're not being sarcastic this morning. We want to talk about the time frame also here. Here it is, 2015. You guys been knocking on this door, getting and going up and down and having successes and having setbacks. And we're this morning on Democratic Perspective, we're going to credit some of the setbacks to the ideological fight between the state and federal entities. But isn't the Grand Canyon a national thing? So other than being in your face about it, can't the national effort to restore wolves there be asserted?
You know, the problem is, and this isn't specific to the canyon and the national park, but the problem is the Fish and Wildlife Service, which of course is also a federal agency, at the very top, Dan Ash, the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service, they always kowtow to the states. I cannot explain it. I mean, they do need their state partners, right? They work on a lot of programs together. But at some point, when the state starts to say things, you know, a month or so ago, the commission said, the Arizona Game and Fish Commission said, no releases of adult wolves, period, in Arizona. That is absurd. And it's time for Dan Ash and the Fish and Wildlife Service to say, look, you're our partners and we respect you, but this has gone too far. We're going to put our foot down. Because they do have the mandate. Arizonans want wolves. The feds want wolves. Everybody wants wolves except a small ideological group of state fish and game agencies and their constituencies, the hunters, the ranchers.
Well, that's
a lot of hunters actually identify with predators like wolves and mountain lions.
Yep.
I don't think they oppose. I don't think a majority. I don't know. I haven't seen a polling or anything, but I don't think a majority of them are appalled at having wolves around.
Only as support, they believe they're supporting ranchers when they are anti-wolf.
Yeah, a lot of times the hunters and the ranchers really are supporting each other. They feel like they're both a persecuted minority. And, you know, I have nothing but respect for good hunters, for sportsmanlike hunters. There are hunters and groups of hunters who have great respect for predators and for predators' role in the ecosystem, so...
I agree, and I certainly know some of them. You can't be in Arizona very long.
So what happened with the up that Mike was asking about? What happened with the ups and downs in the program? So wolves are released. They seem to be doing well, and then the population crashes, and now people are interested, including governmental agencies, are trying to rebuild the wolf population. But is there illegal hunting of wolves?
Poaching. There's definitely illegal killing of wolves. Poaching is the largest cause of mortality among wild wolves. And, you know, that's a crime. And that's taking something that belongs to all of the public and killing it. You know, it's the old shoot, shovel, and shut up stuff.
Isn't it somewhat of an irony that hunters oppose wolves when wolves, in fact, keep the population of the elk herds and of deer healthier and stronger?
Yep, and that's why I think, you know, not all hunters oppose, but the ones that do, I think they just, they haven't caught up with, you know, the modern understanding of how the world works, how the natural world works, what the role of predators is, you know, and even Aldo Leopold, the patron saint of environmentalism, as far as I'm concerned, once had the view that, you know, fewer wolves mean more deer and more deer is good, you know, and then he had an epiphany. He had a change in understanding through his own studies and his own observations that predators are necessary. Predators are a good thing.
The other thing I like to talk about. Is the who here? You talked about, you know, who's the best and the who's working for the wolves besides Eva Sargent there in Tucson, Arizona, and who's working against them? I mean, if you got some names for me, that'd be great.
Great groups working. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of great groups working on wolves. Defenders has always sort of, you know, we sort of joke that we're all about wolves, and that's not really true, but wolves are a huge amount of our work, although we work on all endangered and threatened species. But a whole bunch of the groups, national groups, local groups, regional groups that work on wolves all combine their efforts in a website called MexicanWolves.org. And because there's so many groups working on that site, you know, we sort of got together to make this educational site. It's always up to date, and it's always great.
Yeah, I've been on it. It's quite a good site.
We don't always agree on the details, but we agree on the goal, and we all work together to have this really great information site.
So what's the URL again?
MexicanWolves.org. And it has, you know, actions for people to do. It tells you when there's going to be a rally at the Game and Fish Department. It tells you when your letters are needed. It tells you what's going on with individual packs in the wild. It's really great.
And I just want to say the obvious here. Those two things are really important, but saying the obvious is what we do here. If you have a concern about this, showing up to the rallies really, really helps. And writing the letters really, really helps. It does work. It does matter. I mean, I know a lot of people, especially who aren't too used to the quote-unquote political process, and really that's what you're educating here is the whole Mexican wolf issue is a political process in part, and the letters and the rallies. So finding out who and when and where and going to the websites if is the best way. So what other ways? We have an awful lot of people who aren't necessarily digitally involved.
You know, people can also, we have groups of wolf activists that website, MexicanWolves.org, is building.
There you go.
So
do you know if there's any up here?
If you don't get on the web, you can have one of your friends get on there and tell you we have a pactivist group in Flagstaff that people can join. That's the fun part of activism is, you know, joining with other activists and going out and doing activities, you know, tabling, telling people about wolves, writing letters together. A lot of times when people who have never done sort of activism and political work get involved in it, they just love it because of the social interaction and the excitement and the fact that you're making a difference. So,
I noticed that that Gary and Mike's congressman Gosar, who boycotted the Pope's speech, or
that's right,
he claimed he was going to boycott the Pope's speech because the Pope might talk about climate change. In fact, as he said, he would go if the Pope would change his speech for him. But he's also introduced a bill in Congress with another fellow, I believe Lee, that would take the wolves off the Endangered Species Act. Is that a good idea?
That is a very bad idea. First of all, it's a bad idea for the wolves. Who would believe that it was okay for 110 wolves to be thrown under the bus, you know, taken away their protections? It's a bad idea for the wolves. It's also a bad precedent for the Endangered Species Act. We have so many riders and bills and things this year that are just people trying to tear down the Endangered Species Act. And the Endangered Species Act, just like wolves, is incredibly popular. And I think these politicians are going to find out that you know, the American public is not with them. They are serving an incredibly small, you know, constituency of ideological right-wing people.
Absolutely, and that's the message.
The vast majority, even Republicans, are in the majority in support of the Endangered Species Act if you poll them.
Yeah, some of our local conservationists were all moderate Republicans. I don't know if they still are.
Yep.
And there have been huge successes over in the White Mountains. They reintroduced the Apache trout, which is two of our native trout. And that's a much easier thing to do, right, than trying to reintroduce wolves.
Exactly. Nobody complains about trout, right?
Right.
There's no ideological conflict with trout. And that is a success story for the Endangered Species Act.
I was attacked by a trout once.
You have scars?
Well, yeah. You ate it, though.
I did.
These are animals that when we get involved with them, we eat them. It's a little reverse thing. But,
right.
So we want to point out that our fearful representative is, again, leading the parade in the wrong direction. And who is pretty close to as incompetent
a
leader.
He's an absolutist.
As incompetent a leader as we've ever had in this district. And those two issues that we mentioned on the show this morning, with the Pope and the Endangered Species Act. And I love the idea, and this is the mantra that, I mean, for 45 minutes, I would have been happy if we just chanted that people support the Endangered Species Act. People support the population of Arizona supports the Mexican wolf. Yes, I have friends who are ranchers. I have friends in the ranching business.
Yep.
They are not afraid of, but they are, of the Mexican wolf. But they are afraid of going to the Sundowner and the local watering hole and being harassed by their right-wing friends for their lack of militancy against Mexican wolves. So it does become a social thing. We do want to send... Go ahead, sorry.
One of the most anti-federal counties, anti-wolf counties in the United States is Catron County, New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And I can tell you that if you poll people in Catron County, New Mexico, you will find that just the bare majority, maybe 53-55%, is in favor of wolf recovery. But boy, if you live in that small town, you know, in Reserve New Mexico, Glenwood, somewhere like that, you don't speak up.
No.
because the anti-wolf forces, you know, hold the power and are much more vocal.
They do.
So
it's
difficult.
In struggles here for a national monument, the Tea Party outside groups like Americans for Prosperity. Pour money into the issue. I'm not even sure I understand why not protecting wolves is a right wing issue. And I mean, Gosar is so fanatical that it's hard to understand. He's the only of all the right wing guys in Congress. He's the only one who boycotted the Pope's speech.
Yeah.
So. Why is that a right-wing thing rather than...
I think there's two reasons, and you should know that the Americans for Prosperity, the Koch brothers, which is, of course, the Koch brothers group,
right,
supported a bunch of anti-wolf activity in New Mexico in the last 2 years. And there's two reasons. One is it represents regulation to them. You know, they're anti-regulation, and the ESA is a regulation. Therefore, the other thing is they figured out that wolves are like red meat, right? It basically brings people in. Uh-huh. It brings in the really strong anti-government folks. So the Koch brothers groups basically use wolves bring new people into the fold.
It's okay. Part of the fear of politics. The other thing I think that always happens with wildlife is that you get these movements. You know, it always seems like it's wildlife and the environment against large corporations and developers. And so you have, you know, the recent battle over the prairie sage grouse. And it always comes down to some obscure, relatively obscure animal against progress and business and jobs and development. And it's seldom ever that is the case, but that's always the talking point.
Yeah, exactly. That's just a false choice. You know, we can have both. The sage grouse is not going to put anybody out of business. They might make them change the way they do business a little bit. You know, the Endangered Species Act almost never, and I mean less than 1% of the time, probably less than 0.1% of the time, actually stops any kind of development or project. Usually there's some modifications.
Right.
That's it.
Just a change.
You know, and people have this idea. People have this idea that if there's endangered species here, everything's going to shut down. And sometimes, frankly, it probably needs to, but that's hardly ever the case in reality. Less than 1% of the time, and like I said, probably less than 0.1% of the time.
Well, it does get ugly. I remember the floats in the local parade where the hunters were dining on spotted owl soup, and they put it on the side of the. Of the truck.
Yeah, you know that those spotted owls taste just like bald eagles, really.
Gee, talk about dark humor.
There's a million jokes about that.
Oh, geez.
But you know, the important thing is for people to realize that, first of all, Arizona Game and Fish doesn't represent them, doesn't represent the majority of Arizonans, and is keeping these wolves that people want to see, that people want to bring health back to the land, they're keeping that from happening. And people need to show up and tell them, as long as nobody tells them, as long as they can only serve this small constituency of hunters that are anti-predator and ranchers that are, anti-predator, as long as they don't hear from the rest of us, that's just fine. That's just business as usual.
Well, and that's it. And they need the contact, fish and game. However it happened, fish and game Game and Fish used to be a different, such a non-political organization. But once again,
it's now highly politicized. They're spending tremendous amount of taxpayer money to lobby for more power for Arizona Game and Fish in Washington. I mean, they're sending their direct. They spent $67,000 sending this guy around in 1 year. And the reason they're doing that is because they're using taxpayer and fee money to fight an ideological battle. And they're always on the side, as far as I can tell. And I know they do great work with some endangered species like the black-footed ferret and that. I understand that, but we find them on the anti-environmental side of almost all issues, like the Grand Canyon watershed monument proposal, which would limit uranium funding. Well, Arizona Game and Fish comes up with reasons to be against it, and they're published as if they're a conservation organization.
I stopped buying a fishing license. Go ahead.
That monument proposal is almost entirely on federal land. It's almost entirely on federal land, and that monument is so important. It's not, it could not just be important for wolves or other endangered species and other wildlife. It's important for water quality. It's important for air quality. It's important for all kinds of things. And for Arizona Game and Fish, the commission actually, at the time they discussed that proposal, they actually said, okay, we're against all federal designations of land in Arizona, period.
Is that what it is? Because it didn't seem to make sense. Their reasons didn't seem to make sense to me. When I try to look at it from their side, I thought, wow, this is kind of suspicious. It's boilerplate stuff.
They don't have
just
the resources.
Just think of the increase in tourism when you can see the canyon glow in the dark.
That's right.
Right. Exactly. That monument would be so great for so many things, and for people too. I just hate to see people take these ideological stands. I mean, both defenders and me personally, I try to, I'm an environmentalist, I'm a conservationist, but I try to look at science and think about it, and I even try to say, do I have evidence for, is this just my emotion, or do I have evidence? Do I have a valid reason? And I don't think they're doing that. I think they're stuck in this ideological rut.
For folks that don't know, the Grand Canyon watershed proposal for a national monument protects the watershed of the Grand Canyon to the north and west of the Grand Canyon. Part of the proposal would provide, I don't know, you may know what they're called, but a large linkages so that the deer and elk can move safely from higher to lower elevations. But it would also ban uranium mining and further uranium mines. Any, you know, everything is grandfathered in. So it seems like a very pressing proposal. And it seems odd that given the fact that some of the focus of the monument is on increasing the movement of game successfully, that Arizona mm-hmm. Game and Fish would oppose it with these very, very, I guess, ideological reasons. I don't know quite how to characterize it.
Well, of course. I mean, that's the mantra of the show this morning is this negative, this horrible interface of ideology and practical conservation that isn't that Eva Sargent and her ilk down there at Defenders of Wild, down there, I'm talking about Tucson, are fighting the good fight here. And there's certainly a lot of sympathizers in our audience in the Sedona area. So that's one of the reasons we're so glad to have you on the show this morning. We know that there's we certainly get prodded by our constituency once in a while that we need to do more environmental shows. So,
I love doing this. I'm happy to talk about wolves or anything else.
What other issues?
Invite me back sometime.
Yes, great,
Eva. What other issues should are important in your view in Arizona? We've got 3 whole minutes to answer this question.
An eternity.
You know, I think in Arizona we're kind of hemmed in by a lot of non-progressive politics. And I think the other environmental issues, the monument proposal, dealing with climate change, the responsible siting of renewable energy is huge in Arizona, hugely important because we all want more renewable energy. We have to site it in the right place, not where there's important corridors for wildlife or important species. We don't need to just blade off the desert. We have to do it, you know, what we call smart from the start. That's huge. But all of these things depend on changing the politics of Arizona, on people who do want responsible energy and who don't want climate change denial and don't want hatred of wolves on an ideological level. They need to be active, to get out there and do their part to vote for people that support their values, basically.
I think, unfortunately, the source of the conflict between environmentalists and the ideologues is that there's an assumption that environmentalists are against mining, for example. I don't think environmentalists are against mining in general. I think they're against irresponsible miners. That too often, you know, businesses like mining, shove the consequences of their extraction onto the public, and so we're forced to suffer the consequences while they run off with the money.
They get rich, and we pay the bills for the cleanup. The
exactly.
public pays the bills for the cleanup for like these coal mines and stuff that were never stabilized. I could rant on.
That are still leaking.
It's still leaking all over
Arizona.
I hiked up there, I saw the stuff that we're
against.
I need to make a plug for our sponsor.
Yes.
We are sponsored in part by Democrats of the Red Rocks, and the group has a picnic coming up on Sunday, October 11th at 11:30 a.m. 11:30 to 3:30, I believe, is the time. And it's apropos to this topic in that it's going to be a lot of ecological displays and groups presenting.
Right. It's going to be the focus is going to be on there'll be a lot of different ecological groups, local groups making a presentation. Mike, you want to wrap this up for us?
And yes,
say goodbye to
absolutely. David? You can VVID is where you can find this show. VVID.org. Find this show.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.